desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul. We each have an inherent wish to create something that did not exist before. The more you trust and rely upon the Spirit, the greater your capacity to create.
I'm Nancy Hansen, and this is Everything Creative. This program explores a wide range of creative ideas, talents, and experiences through interviews and group discussions. Today, mother and author Joyce Erickson interviews author Glenn Leonard.
Welcome back to Everything Creative. My name is Joyce Erickson, and I am here with Glenn Leonard, a wonderful man who loves history, who has authored and co-authored several books, and a man who just happens to be my daughter's father-in-law. The first time that I ever met Glenn Leonard was when the two of us were asked to speak at a women's conference in Bountiful. I didn't know him and he didn't know me, but I was greatly touched by some of the stories that he told about Nauvoo and things that happened there. And there was one particular incident that he told about was a letter that was written about the Prophet Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, the day after the Prophet and Hiram were martyred. And I was greatly touched by that. And that's the first time I met Glenn. But the second time I met Glenn was when my daughter and his son introduced themselves as about ready to be married. So Glenn and I have had good conversations in the past. Glenn, could you introduce yourself by telling us a little bit about your background, including some personal interests, your most recent job as the director of the Church History Museum, and the books you've authored or co-authored?
I'd be glad to, Joe. If you had known me as a younger man, in fact, if you knew me well today, you would notice that one of my interests is photography. I'm interested in family pictures and landscapes and flowers and compositions, and I guess it's the visual side that once headed me off in a career path that would have made me an architect. But I also enjoy reading. I like to keep up on current events, and I like to read short stories, and of course, when I have time, history. My premise is that if you're writing, you have to read. And I also enjoyed English and outlining, and that's part of what I do to prepare for talks and interviews, is put my thoughts down in outline form. So my interest in reading and writing headed me off with a minor in journalism. And I loved English, loved poetry, and have done a little writing of poetry. I started with the limericks, you know, the fun kinds.
Are you kidding me?
and you know, I'd write them for my cousins when they got engaged and had a shower. I'd write little poems that would characterize them, kind of give a caricature, a fun caricature. But I like to listen to classical jazz and classical music, folk music. I do a little music making myself on the piano, and I've been an organist for many years in my earlier years.
So am I correct that you write poetry?
You didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
That's one of my ways of expressing my creativity, is poems that capture personality profiles and express feeling. In fact, once at the University of Utah in an English class, we had to do a paper on one of the New England writers, and I wrote that paper in verse, the whole paper in verse.
You are kidding.
That's a brave thing to do when the professor himself is a poet. But I expressed my findings about this writer and got an A on the paper. How about that? And photography is, of course, the other way I express my visual creativity. But I still do poems.
So do you have a poem there?
Yeah. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Well, this is my latest poem. It was written for my wife. It's titled On Mother's Day, 2009. A mother is her child's best friend, her husband's confidant. She sacrifices time and means to meet their needs and wants. A mother has a listening ear and lips that speak to share life's secrets and kind, loving words that always say, I care. A mother lives to bring new life, to nurture, teach, and heal. She knows the way to make things right. Her guileless love is real. So on this annual day for moms, two thoughts remain to say. You have my love. I wish for you a happy Mother's Day.
That's great, Glenn. I didn't know you had that side about you.
You mean your husband doesn't write poems for you?
No, he doesn't. He's an engineer.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Well, I'm curious, Glenn, why do you like doing history?
You know, the bottom line for doing history for me is that it helps me know who I am. I find as I read about other people in biographies and as I read about the past and learn about people, no matter what time it is, ancient or recent history, I learn something about me. And so I write it to explore and find who I am and also to hopefully help other people as they read what I write discern who they are. I think there are things to be learned about ourselves besides the people and the places that we're writing about. And that's a creative process, trying to understand what's happened in the past because, as one historian said, the past is a foreign country and we really can't go there. We are, in a sense, taking the sources we find, evaluating them, and recreating a story that may not capture everything that happened. And in fact, it can't. Consider the circles. The biggest circle is everything that happens. That's history. Then the next inner circle, which is much smaller, is the information that's captured on some kind of a record. In the old days, it was writing. Uh-huh. Now we have a lot of other sources. And then go in smaller in this circle, and you have information that survives, because not everything that's recorded survives. And then within that is the information you as a historian are able to locate when you're searching on a certain topic. And once you have that, then you narrow it further because you can't use everything you find. So you sort that out, and then you pick what you want to find, that which makes sense to you, and that's still history. And then the final product is the history you write, whether it's a personal history or a family or a community or whatever. And that's also called history. So at one end, it's history as it happens, and at the other end is history as we have recreated it, because it is really a glimpse into the past, a shortened version that doesn't have every single minute, but just has a generalized account. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. As a matter of fact, I can relate to that because when Bruce and I, my husband and I, were writing our book, that very thing happened. We had all of this information and all of this stuff we wanted to write about our family, and I couldn't believe how much we had to throw out in writing the thing. So it was interesting to someone else.
You mentioned my Nauvoo book. It was too long, and I needed to cut it. But cutting something after it's written is hard. I told Deseret Book I need 2 years, and they said, well, get started. After a year, they said, time's up, and I said, I'm only halfway through. So the first half of the book got cut by about 10 or 15%. The last half is full.
Is that right?
You know, I had an opportunity to show a kind of creativity that I usually don't when I did a class at the Museum of Church History. Our docents who take tours in the Church History Gallery were offered a short history of the church, a short class, a short version of the church history. So I organized it, outlined it, created three periods of church history, divided each of those periods into three subsets, and then for each subset I picked a theme. And each time we got to that new theme in subsequent each time we met, I introduced that subset with a hymn, bringing in music.
Really?
So for the first one, which was the restoration of the gospel, the hymn I chose was, obviously, the Spirit of God, like a fire is burning. That hymn captures for me the essence of that period of the Restoration. Remember, it talks of angels and visions and
that really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it captures it. And that, for me, covered the period from That period captures for me that Restoration period from 1820 to the end of the Missouri period. The second period, I called a period in which they were building the kingdom from 1839 to 1869. That's the pioneering period. It finishes Nauvoo and moves west, so come, come, you saints, which captures not only the concept of moving west, but the concept that together we can do it, you know, all is well. And the third part of that first section, from 1869, when the railroad came, until 1887, when we get to the end of that pioneer period, you're defending the truth and right. The church is being attacked for various reasons. So the hymn is true to the faith. So we have restoration, consecration, and retrenchment. Three hymns and three themes. And I did that for all of the nine sections. And you know, that helped the class get into the spirit of the message, because we began that section by singing the hymn.
Uh-huh.
And then we got into those ideas that the hymn introduced. Have you ever tried that in a church history class?
No,
I've never done it before.
No.
In any kind of a history
class. That's really interesting. Hmm. Glenn, when we talked on the phone, I liked what you said to me. You said to me, in order to understand the past like you have said, a historian has to be a sleuth, a detective. He must be creative in knowing where to look for clues and then how to create the historical story to tell by searching, finding, and evaluating. That was really intriguing to me, and you've touched on that a little bit. Is there any more detail that you would like to give us as a listener?
Yes, I can talk a lot about that. Let me say just one more thing about my background, if I may.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll go on to that. You know, you ask me why I like to do history. Let me orient you just a minute on how I came to work in the kinds of history I did. I grew up next door to an aunt who was both an English teacher and a kind of a family history keeper.
Well, there you are.
And she was single, a single adult living alone, and so I was her next door nephew. And she had a huge influence on me in introducing me to family history. She had the family diaries that were handed off to me to preserve. And then I came from that family history idea in seventh grade Utah history to look more broadly to see the context of my family. But then when I got into the university, I was interested in the community itself and did a thesis on Farmington, my hometown. And then when I got into the master's, into the doctoral program, I widened the field into Western American history.
My goodness.
So I'm just getting a broader geographically. And I spent some time at the Historical Society here in Utah, writing and editing, and I wrote a history of the society. So I was starting into institutional history. Next thing I knew, I was down the road into the church history division, writing church history. And I had just finished teaching a church history class for Sunday school.
Huh. Interesting how those often tie together.
Yeah,
huh?
So that they were working together. And then finally, I'm back again in institutional history. So from family to state to community. And I, in all of these areas, plus other fields that I delved in, like medieval history, colonial American history, history of science, I could tie it to me because I had personal interests in the kinds of subject matter that you had there. And so as I began writing, which began with essays and then articles, theses and dissertations, four books and lots more articles, I had by then developed a methodology for finding. And I guess one of the methods is simply the journalistic method. The journalists ask who, where, what, when. And the historian says, and how, or why.
Uh-huh.
And we want to put some more meaning in it than just researching. So sometimes it's really serendipitous. You go looking for something else, and you find what you're not looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. When I was museum director, the staff was too busy, so I took on the assignment of curating an exhibit for the New York Historical Society. This was to be a collaborative effort between them and us. They had a huge collection of Mormon books and pamphlets, some of them anti-Mormon, some of them published by Latter-day Saints. We had a nice collection of art telling the history of the church, and we also had access to illustrations, lithographs, and such in the church archives. So working with their curator, they gave me a list of books they wanted to display, and we got some illustrations to match them. And we titled the display From New York to Salt Lake, meaning the church began in upstate New York with Joseph Smith, and it came west. And we showed the exhibit there and also showed it here in Salt Lake. But one of the pieces they pulled out, which I wasn't expecting, because they basically collect library things, was a pencil sketch. And it's labeled Joe Smith of Nauvoo, July 1842.
Really?
It's a little profile. Some unidentified artist had been in Nauvoo in 1842 and sketched this profile of Joseph Smith. Well, that was in the exhibit, and in fact, I've used it in my Nauvoo book because it's an unknown, until that time, to us, first-person experience with the prophet.
Wow.
There were two other artists doing images of him that same year that have come down to us through normal channels. But here is a third version, an amateur, but it's a nice little piece. Well, you wanted some examples. As a sleuth, those are the questions that I use, and the evaluation is the most important part, you know, trying to figure out what's happening and why.
Yeah, that's probably the hardest part.
It's the most fun, though.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's like being a detective. You take all the pieces and see if you can put them together.
Uh-huh. That part was extremely intriguing to me when you were telling me that it really kind of is like being a detective. with that background, maybe you could share some stories that you've uncovered, perhaps from your studies regarding the Nauvoo period, maybe some things about family and community histories. And then, if we have time, perhaps touch on some lessons that you've learned as you searched and evaluated the situation at Mountain Meadows. But first, just let's begin with your work on the history of Nauvoo, which you've written about in your book, Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People of Promise. Would you share some of your thoughts and maybe some stories about what you uncovered?
Sure. T. Edgar Lyon, who was Mr. Nauvoo to everyone, research historian for Nauvoo Restoration and an institute teacher, was planning to write this book. He had done a little research, and he had all of the information that he gathered when he was working with Nauvoo Restoration, trying to get information about how to restore buildings and interpret them. But he was suddenly threatened with death, with cancer. And so he and I agreed to co-author the book.
Really?
I had a half a dozen meetings with him before he was too ill to meet with me. So his wife left the papers with me. I went through them and discovered I had an outline for each chapter, and I had some materials, but I had to do a lot of research.
Uh-huh.
It took me a long time to get around to doing it because of other responsibilities, but when I finally got serious over a 10-year period, I ended up with the book. But as I went through his materials, I would find little notes that he'd written to himself. And I'd usually find them too late. That is, for example, I'd write a section and go looking for something else and turn up the note, which would say, emphasize this.
Really?
Or pay attention to that. And I'd think, oh, I did.
Maybe you were inspired.
I often felt that Ed was looking over my shoulder.
Really?
Yeah, things like that would happen. I think, oh, okay, that's what you wanted me to do. The family, he has seven sons, realized it wouldn't be his voice or most of his research, but I tried to take what I read in the outline and fill in the blanks and make a history out of it. He wanted it to be an honest history, you know, pull no punches. And I wrote an honest history, and I remember some people responded to it by saying, how do you get away with that? You know, we don't talk about those things in that way. But we live in a time when candor is the way to write Mormon history.
I think it is.
And also I tried to make Nauvoo a religious history. That is, a history about a religious people. Some people challenged my title, A Place of Peace. Wasn't Nauvoo a place of trouble? And I said, well, if you'd lived there, there were occasional outbursts of trouble. But for most of those half dozen years, people lived ordinary lives. And I read 1,000 letters written back and forth to Nauvoo, and I can prove it. They were concerned about family and about their religion and trying to share the gospel with members who were non-member relatives who were living elsewhere. And so it was a place of peace, but the peace came because of their knowledge of the temple and what it meant. And that became increasingly important to them during those years. Some of those letters are really people talking from the heart. And you mentioned earlier the account about Lucy Mack Smith. I'm going to share that for our audience, because you were touched by it, and I was too. It's a letter written by Sarah Kimball. She's the woman who suggested that an organization be formed by women to help sew clothes for the temple workers.
Uh-huh.
Ended up being the Relief Society. Her husband was a merchant in Nauvoo, an old commerce. And she was writing to the wife of another merchant, and that's Sarepta Haywood, and they lived in Quincy, a few miles south of Nauvoo. And here's how the letter begins. On Friday afternoon, the day after the murders, I rode out, for what purpose I hardly know. But I directed my course to the mansion. She's speaking here of the mansion house where Joseph and Emma lived. I resorted to Mother Smith's room, the room in which you presented slippers. Mother Smith had a room upstairs, and apparently Sarepta Haywood had given some slippers to Joseph Smith.
Wow.
In fact, in another letter, I discovered that after the prophet's death, Emma gave the slippers back to Brother Haywood as a keepsake. As I entered the door, the first personage that I seemed to recognize was the afflicted Mother Smith. She was seated in her armchair near the far corner of the room. She beckoned me to come to her. As I approached her, she extended her trembling hand towards me, which I clasped in silence. She, biting her lips, motioned me to be seated by her side. I think for 3 minutes the silence was only broken by smothered sobs from various parts of the room, during which time the pressure of her trembling hand and the heaving of her swollen bosom spoke, as it were, volumes to my heart. It was then that I vainly wished for powers of speech to console the afflicted. At last I ventured to say, Mother Smith, how are you today? She replied, oh, I can't tell, for my poor heart does ache so. How could they kill my poor boys? Oh, how could they kill them when they were so precious? I'm sure they would not harm anybody in the world, but they would have done everybody good. There was poor Hiram. What could they kill him for? He was always mild. Then turning to Lucy, who was her youngest daughter, she said, don't you know, Lucy, how mild Hiram always was? Etc., etc. Brother Haywood is now waiting for this letter, and I'm obliged to close in the middle of my subject.
That touches me once again. That those kind of things are marvelous, and they tie us to those people because they become very real at that point. And what a wonderful thing for you to have discovered and to share with us. Are there any other things that you would like to share about that Nauvoo period? Or
Perhaps one. I've often been invited to talk about Nauvoo, and I've formulated an approach which uses some of these people that I met through their letters. And there's a series of letters written by James Jones. He's a 50-year-old bootmaker from England. And he's writing to his son, Henry, who's in his mid-20s. Henry stays behind. He's married. He doesn't join the church. He doesn't come to Nauvoo. But James and his wife and their 5 other children come to Nauvoo. When they get near Puerto Rico, Mary dies and is buried at sea. And in James Jones's first letter home to his son, when they reach New Orleans, he tells Henry about this. He says, "After we buried her, I went into the captain's cabin, looked in the logbook, and got the latitude and longitude."
Oh, my.
So on the morning of the resurrection, I'll know where to claim her. Can you believe that?
That's a good story.
Then after he got to Nauvoo, he wrote another letter, and this is a few months later. "There has been a glorious principle taught that has been revealed from the Lord to the prophet of being sealed for eternity to those who have lost their partners. And without this sealing power, no one can claim their bosom friends in another world. I've met with some of the heads of the church respecting attendance to this ordinance, but it has not been done as yet. Whether it can be done before the temple of the Lord is finished, I cannot tell as yet. But I assure you, I am very anxious about it. There are many glorious truths taught here which makes my very heart rejoice, things that we never heard of in England. I know that this is the work of the Lord. I know that it's the will of the Lord that every honest-hearted person must be to come here, for there is no other place of salvation for the temple family. There's no other place of salvation for the human family."
Wow.
That story goes on letter after letter, and it's one of heartbreaks and joy.
That kind of connects them to us in a lot of ways, I think. I'm just amazed the way you make Nauvoo history come to life. And the thing that I find kind of interesting, you know, when I read the title of your book, what was it called again? A Place of Peace, A People of Promise.
Uh-huh.
I remember the first time I went to Nauvoo about 30 years ago, and my overwhelming feeling when I got there was, this is a very peaceful place. And
sure.
I couldn't help but think, no wonder those people didn't want to leave this place, because it really was a peaceful place. I understand that someday you hope to write a history of one of your ancestral families. How would you go about doing that?
Well, what I'm finding is the best way to write biography is to, of course, work hard to find the sources, but to put it into a context. I'm working on my great-grandfather on my father's side, Truman Leonard, who kept lots of diaries. He served a mission in India. That's 5 years of his life. And he keeps the diary till he gets home and then till the last book fills up.
Oh, my.
Then he goes on two missions to Ohio to gather genealogy each 6 months in the 70s. And so here's the 30-year-old keeping the early 30s, keeping the missionary diary. And then when he's in his 50s, he spends 2 6-month times meeting relatives. So we get acquainted with the family. And then he starts running from the feds who are after this man because he's got three wives now. And so he goes into hiding, and he spends most of the last 10 years of his life in Canada. He comes home occasionally, but he's keeping a diary the whole time. So you see what's going on in his life, and he comes to Farmington and sees what's going into the lives of the two wives that are there. His middle wife is in Canada with one of the girls. And so there he's in his mid-60s to mid-70s, and the last year of his life, he and my great-grandmother, who's living in Farmington and her half of the Rock home, have some differences about who's to pay the taxes. She had been deeded half the house, and the second wife got the other half, but she's in Canada, and so there's some unhappiness there. And a couple of months later, Truman says this in his diary. He's talking about the garden work he's doing. "It turned the water off my sugarcane ground and also drained the water off my oats in the lower field as they were being swamped by water from the roses and from True," which was one of his sons. And then right there, he interrupts and writes this poem. "To my sweetheart, now and ever. I wish I were a smile to play about your cheeks. It would make my life a pleasure to feast upon the sweets. In my hallucinations, I would wander through the nights, and in my wakeful moments, I would enjoy the sights. Oh, yes, I should be happy. My heaven would be on earth. Continuous, my peace would last, a flow of modest mirth. And then, alas, when time is called upon this mundane sphere, eternity will then provide means so ample, joys forevermore." By Truman Leonard, May 15th, 1897.
You've kept the tradition going.
And he died in December.
Did he?
Yeah.
Just last December?
No.
December of
1897.
Yeah.
And he's in his 77th year. So, you know, you get to know your ancestors when you discover things like that.
Absolutely.
And he wrote a short history about his parents and family and his conversion story. But yet, there's much more left to fill in the gaps between the diaries. And so the creative part is to say, who would know the stories that he doesn't tell? For example, he says nothing about coming to Utah in 1850 or where he was between the time they left Nauvoo and they got to Utah. Well, they were in Iowa somewhere, and lo and behold, one of my aunts found a record of the birth of a child stillborn in northern Iowa. Mm-hmm. We knew of a second child buried in the winter quarters area in the cemetery there. In fact, the first wife had no sons who lived. They buried four or five of them.
And so there's the example of your detective work.
And only one daughter who lived. But I thought, you know what? I know where to find it. I was working on Nauvoo and looking at a Nauvoo diary and reading it, and it was a woman who was doing nothing but complaining about her health and every day telling the medicine she was taking. And it was fascinating, so I kept reading, and all of a sudden, I realized they were moving out and going somewhere in wagons, and it was an immigrant train, and guess who she mentioned? Brother Leonard. Truman Leonard and his wife, Hortensia, were in that immigrant train, and they were mentioned often.
Wow.
So I followed them across the plains, and then years later discovered that the church history department has on its webpage a pioneer immigration site where they list all of the people who were in every immigrant company as far as they're known. And they also list sources about that trip. And they have some of them right there online. You can click it and read it and print it. Others you have to go to the library because it's longer. So there all those accounts of the trek, including some diaries, and you go in and you can fill in the story and tell about the crossing of the plains in 1850. I also found when I was working on Farmington history a few years ago that there are some very accurate minutes. The bishop got the teachers' quorum, who were adults, together every week, and it was kind of his ward council. And they dealt with, you know, things that were problems and helping the widows and dealing with putting brands on somebody else's cattle and then dealing with the report from Brother Moon, Truman's neighbor, who says he was beating these oxen. So Truman was disfellowshipped for a few days to remind him he shouldn't beat those oxen. So you get to know their personality. And some of the people living in Farmington who were living there when he was would mention him from time to time. Brother Truman made a harrow for me. Or we did some shares, you know, and helping each other with our crops. Not long ago, I was doing some family history work. I'm a family history consultant in our ward. And I was looking for some information. I went into Ancestry.com and looking for some census records. And all of a sudden, I noticed that they were offering passport applications. I thought, well, that's interesting. And the dates included from this late 1700s, you know, right on. So I put in Truman Leonard's name, and guess what?
Really?
There was his passport when he went to India in 1852.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And they had a place for a photo, but there wasn't one. So in lieu of a photo, they wrote a description of this person. So if you handed your passport to the agent, he could look at you and look at the passport and figure out if you were the person described. So it says age, 32 years. They filled in the blanks. Stature, 5 feet, 7 and a half inches. He's a lot shorter than we thought he was. Forehead, round. Eyes, hazel, light. And he did have light hazel eyes. You can see that in the photographs we have here. Nose, large. Mouth, diminutive. Chin, small. Hair, dark brown. Complexion, rather dark. And face, average size. So do you think that would describe my great-grandfather?
Oh, my goodness gracious. You must have thought you hit a gold mine when you found
that. That was fun.
I bet that was really fun.
We only had one picture of him until I discovered that my aunt had another one that she turned up somewhere of a later period. And then at a Memorial Day gathering for the Leonard clan a few years ago, a young woman who is a descendant of the Canada Leonards, showed up at the cemetery in Farmington and talked to one of my cousins, and she invited her to the picnic. When she came, I discovered her line of the family had another picture of Truman Leonard. So in those days when photos weren't taken very often because it was expensive, we now have three different versions of what his face looked like, so we have something for the passport if he ever needs it again.
You mentioned talking about the history of Farmington. Uh-huh. Haven't you been asked to write a book about the history of Davis County, Utah?
Well, I wrote one of Davis County, and one of the city councilors knew about that and said, we need a history of Farmington. And I said, well, have you seen my thesis? So he borrowed that and read that. And so they invited me to do a full-blown history, bring it up to date. And so I'm working on that, yes. I've got two more years to finish it, and I'm still working on the first two chapters. So wish me luck. But, you know, I think community history is like family history. You have to be creative because in the community you have a lot of people living there. And taken together, they form the community. But unfortunately, for those who want to read the book, all of their ancestors won't be in that book. When the county book came up, I saw some people coming up, opening, looking in the index. Their relative wasn't there, so they closed it and put it down. You have to select who gets on stage.
Uh-huh.
And it's somewhat subjective because, first of all, if they have something to say or are doing something which makes history or describes history, then you can use them. For example, not long ago I found a firsthand account of the 1923 flood in Farmington. This man was there. He was doing things. He wrote what he was doing. And it's the only firsthand account I've ever found. I found plenty of scientific studies afterwards and,
uh-huh.
and plenty of newspaper articles that give the basic story. But here is a personal thing. And so you're dealing with a kind of an institutional community kind of story, but you have to bring in biography as well. And so there are some challenges there. One of them is there are a lot of traditional stories going around. For example, the one that says Brigham Young was out in Farmington and he got caught in an east wind. We're known for our east winds
uh-huh.
there.
Yeah.
And it blew his wagon over, and he got up and cursed the wind, and it hasn't blown as much since. And you can actually find that story in Tullidge's History of Utah in as many words. And he frames the story as if, you know, they used to have strong winds there, but they're not as strong as they used to be. And, of course, when I told that story, people in Farmington know that that's not true. The wind still blows very, very, very strong. So I thought, well, I wonder if there is a source for that. And lo and behold, Brigham Young described that event. Tullidge says it was about 1863, and Brigham actually dates it to 1865, but that's close enough. And it was published in the Deseret News and then reprinted in the Millennial Star. And here's Brigham's report, firsthand, okay?
Okay.
We were caught by a violent storm of wind, which raged so furiously and carried the snow which had fallen the previous night so fiercely in our faces that it seemed quite questionable for a time whether we would be able to reach Farmington or not. They're coming from Kaysville.
Okay.
And I could imagine getting there on the brow of the hill by the junction and, you know, having the wagon tipped over. But here's what he says next. We were compelled to stop there all the afternoon and night, the storm being so violent during that time that it was quite impossible to travel. Okay, let's interpret that. Were they compelled to stop because the wagon was blown over, or were they compelled to stop because the wind was too strong to travel through? I don't know. I don't know. I would read it at face value and say he didn't say it blew over. Was he embarrassed? Or did he not feel it worth reporting? Or didn't it happen?
Mm-hmm. Those are the detective kind of questions you come up with.
The other thing that I find interesting in local history is, and I've read a lot of local histories to see how other people write them, is in Farmington and others, they mention the pioneers, you know, the first settlers.
Uh-huh.
And in the local histories in Farmington, they identify 22 families who arrived between 1847 and 1850. But if you look at the 1850 census, which was actually done in early 51, you find there's 73 families and 280 people. 57 of them are farmers. It's Farmington. And 80% of them are New Yorkers. That is, 80% of the adults were born in New York State. This opened the door to me to say, you know, people like to live among similar people.
Uh-huh.
Brigham Young came to Farmington once and says, I feel at home here. Well, he was an upstate New Yorker, too. But that's twice as many New Yorkers in a town as there are in the state on average in 1850. So, you know, they come because of friends or extended family. But is that all that was there? No, we're missing some. So how do you find them? Well, the census provides some. And the census is a good way to get at them. But when I looked at the 1850 census, there were names that I'd never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Because they came for a time and then they moved. I'm not only interested in who was there, but where were they living? And the census lines them up in order of the visit by the census taker. So you try to say, okay, he's going from door to door, but suddenly he's down here and then he's over here. He's looping around. He starts in Farmington. He goes up through Kaysville. He comes back. He goes into Centerville and he goes back around west and then comes back into Farmington. So there's some kind of a looping to get everybody. But in Farmington, I found a map. At the county courthouse, which was undated, but because of the names on it, I was able to determine it's about 1850. How do I know that? Truman Leonard arrived somewhere between 23rd of September and the 1st of October. One of his traveling companions said the 23rd. The official record for the company says the 30th. But Truman was in ahead of one of the groups. They call them a TAN, which means, you know, it's kind of a military title. And he and a co-captain were out ahead of the main company, so I think they got on the 23rd. And when they got there, he went to Farmington because his younger brother, who had arrived in 1847, had already claimed some land out there that he was owning in concert with two of his neighbors. So Truman goes out there sometime after he arrives, the end of September. But the map has somebody else living on the land that we know he was on. So how do you explain that? Well, I looked up that person's name and family history records, and guess what? He had a child born in 1851 in Ogden. So he left there, didn't he, sometime after the map was made and before Truman arrived? Well, that's interesting because the records of the land in Farmington are available from a number of sources. Not only does that map show the exact location and who owns it, but it allows me to look at the neighbors. So here is this Henry Beckstead on what became the Leonard land, and next to them to the south is Albert Knapp, who's living next to his father-in-law, Isaac Shepherd, and west of them is the pasture where Albert Knapp, John Leonard, and Truman Leonard have a pasture. Now, John had a lot in Salt Lake City, a building lot over where West High School is. I learned that from the maps of Salt Lake.
My goodness.
But he's also got this land out here. Does he have a place to live there? Probably not yet. When the city was surveyed in 1853, they laid out a city on somebody's farmland, and then they built a fort because Brigham Young said they had to. But I discovered that the Beckstrand family had arrived in the 1849 immigrant company with Alan Taylor, who happened to be just up the road from the Beckstrand, the next property up the road, according to the census. So they came out there together for some reason. I don't think they knew them before. Beckstead's from Kentucky, or Taylor's from Kentucky, and the Beckstead's had come from and upstate New York into Ontario and came into Nauvoo and west. But Henry's family lives over in South Jordan and West Jordan, over in the south end of the valley. His father and his parents and some of his siblings are. So he makes it up there, goes to Ogden, then turns around after a few years and heads back to the Jordan area to be with his family. So he's moving a lot, and that's another thing I find, mobility. Families are going everywhere, and they're not staying very long. They're looking for better opportunities with farms and building their farms. There came a time when the folks in Farmington wanted to get title to their property. The federal land office didn't open until 1869. And then they were able to file on the land they were owning and they had described with local surveys. In order to get official ownership, you had to have someone certify that they knew you, that you're a man of good character, and you'd been there for a while and you'd improved on the property. So Truman Leonard got George Bourne to write a little note, fill in a form, to describe this man and his property. Look what we learned from it. He said, Truman Leonard entered upon and made a settlement in person on the property that he's just described. He's been there since the first day of June 1841. In other words, the law said it had to be after that date. But he came on the first day of October 1850, right on. And he has erected a house thereon that's 16 by 32 feet. 16-foot logs, double width, mm-hmm. double length, single width, a roof, a floor, two doors, three windows, and it's a comfortable place to live in. And he has cultivated, he has plowed, fenced, and cultivated about 45 acres of said land and has 160 rods of fencing, 100 rods of water ditches, corrals, stables, stockyards, orchard, etc. Said improvements are worth about $1,000 at least.
My goodness.
Now, there's no barn mentioned here. That's okay. This is 1874. We've learned from the diary that he didn't build the barn until the last years of his life, in the late 1880s, early 1890s. But we know all the other things he had in improvements. So just this land record tells us how big the house, how many windows, and we learn from his diary late in life that there were three log homes side by side. He had three wives, but one of them lived in town on a home that the 70s built for his wife while he was on his mission in India. His youngest brother, John, lived in one of the homes, and so that left two for the other wives. One of them lived in town, and so the third wife lived in the log home and bore six of her seven children while living there.
Wow.
We know that because then we discover by that diary reference when he built the rock home, because he says, oh, he was out in the orchard working. He said, I just thought about the old three homes that used to be here. And Mary Ann bore six of our children there.
Interesting.
So she lived there from 1857 for six children before she got the little half of the rock house. So the family history begins to come together with that kind of information.
So would you recommend that we all write diaries?
I wish you would. Don't you?
Yes.
Good for you.
It would be a good thing, wouldn't
it? Good for you. Yeah.
The one thing that really becomes obvious as you talk is that a historian really is a detective. Asking yourself these questions and putting the answers together. If we have a little time, I'd like to talk a little bit about your most recent book about the incident in Mountain Meadows.
Uh-huh.
What are some things that you learned that we as readers of that history might be inspired by? What are some lessons that can be learned from that history?
Well, as you know, it's a sad history. It's a story that when some people read it, they say, that's a terrible book. What they mean, it's well written, but it's a terrible story. But you know, Shakespeare wrote of tragedies, and the Bible, the Old Testament particularly, has tragic stories of good men who make bad decisions and fall from grace. And that's what this story is about. And there's some lessons that we try to convey in the book that can help us all make better choices. And one of those is it's important that we don't prejudge people, that we accept them as who they are, that we're tolerant of their differences, and that we take into account who they are and where they're coming from, because they may be biased against us or say things that they don't mean, and we shouldn't jump to conclusions. And that's part of what was happening in southern Utah. But we do the same things, and people who've studied violence say that's part of the pattern of violence. You you get acquainted with someone and you say, oh, they might be bad for us. We better be ready to defend ourselves. And then you say, you know, they may really hurt us. We ought to get ready. And then you say, you know, maybe we ought to take a little preemptive action to, you know, scare them away. And then things get out of hand and you say, you know, let's go get them. That's how wars get started.
It is.
That's how organized violence gets going. So there's something to learn about that. And another thing that's related to that is we saw in the story that we're telling that these good men were meeting in council meetings in which they were getting advice. But those who felt strongly, most strongly about taking some kind of strong action or getting justice from what was happening, little minor things, weren't listening. Three or four different meetings when they were told to pull off, and they didn't. And ultimately, things got out of control where they decided they had to do what they did just to protect themselves. So, you know, leaders who have leadership meetings where they meet together in council, the man in charge who has to make the decision is best served by taking counsel and listening.
What great advice.
That works in family councils, too. And finally, we ask our readers, you're human and they were human. You have frailties and they did. What would you have done had you been there? Whose side would you have been on? Who would you have listened to? Would you have listened to leaders without questioning for yourself and coming to an acceptance of the counsel or orders that were given to you in a military sense? Would you have opposed it? Would you have stood up for what you thought was right? Would you have fallen to the peer pressure around you as everybody's getting on the bandwagon? Would you have said no? What would you have done? And that's the hard question, because we all have the potential as good people to do things that we wouldn't ordinarily do.
Those are all very pertinent to what's going on today, even asking ourselves those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Very much so. Just as a final question, could you just explain a little bit how your creativity has helped you fulfill your church calling? I don't know if you want to include any of your experience as a stake president or not, but you did mention to me that your creativity has really helped you fulfill your calling as a high priest group instructor, as a senior missionary with your wife, and a ward family history consultant. Could you just comment on that as you summarize for our listeners to know how being creative in your writing or just summarize that for us.
Okay. I think in everything we do in life, we need to have the Spirit with us, and it works in our professions and in our ordinary lives. But I think when we're doing the Lord's work, there is a more urgent need to have the Spirit with us. And whatever the calling is I've had, and I've had a variety of different kinds of callings, two or three that were actually teaching in the classroom, but I've been counseled and I have felt that in no matter what my assignment was, I am a teacher by example, but also a teacher. And, you know, you counsel with people, you're teaching them, you interview them, you're teaching, you get at the pulpit, you're teaching. And we're always teaching, our lives are teaching. And, of course, the Spirit helps us to be creative because each teaching situation is different because we need to teach the person who's there to be taught to touch their hearts and hopefully influence them to change the behavior if that's necessary. I remember as a teacher in the gospel doctrine class, I was there for 7 years in Bountiful and thoroughly loved it because I spent all day Saturday getting ready. I learned more than the class did. But you know, I learned in junior high that I could evaluate, I could outline, and as a teacher I try to grasp the meaning of it, pull out the essence, and then communicate it as clearly as I can with, you know, fun examples and such. And recently, I was asked to substitute in a 17-year-old Sunday school class, and the lesson was on consecration. The teacher says, I don't want to teach this. Will you come and do it? So I brought a bottle of olive oil and a small bottle of consecrated olive oil and says, what's the difference between these? And they sort of came up with it, that one is consecrated to the Lord's purposes, the other one is used for cooking. and a meeting house is consecrated, but the mill isn't. So, you know, we went through a few of those examples, and then I brought out a deed that I'd found in Nauvoo, a consecration deed, and I read it to them, and Stephen Abbott lists everything that he owns. He's a builder or carpenter of some kind, so he lists all of his tools, and then he lists his land, and then he lists his debts, people owe him $250, so he consecrates that debt as well. And then concludes, I do hereby declare that I am willing to submit to the consecration law and do the will of God in all things. In that lesson, there's a quote from Elder Maxwell in his talk. The only thing we really have to give, because everything is the Lord's, is our will. And so we talked about that a little. And then I said, you know, one of these deeds that I didn't read to them concludes with the sentence, and I consecrate my wife and all of our children to you, to the church. Of course, all of their time and talents and his own are consecrated along with what you owe, what you own. It's part of that thing. So that was a little creativity, you know, keep their attention by introducing an example and also some objects to look at.
We certainly have to do that with 17-year-olds, don't we?
We do. I was a missionary. One of our jobs was to be what you would call here a membership locator. The bishop said our priority is to get the membership records straightened out. We have 700 or 800 people we don't know, and we don't know whether they live here or not or where they live. So we used every method we could think of, knocking on doors, calling on telephones, getting on the web and looking at records of people where they move. But we called on one house, and the gardener was there, and he said, you know, I worked here 16 years, and the man you're looking for hasn't lived here in that time. We thought, he's been gone that long? He was an older man. And so we checked out some of the usual things, and we were able to find him in Boise. And then I thought, his last name is Earl. My great-grandfather, Truman Leonard, had two daughters who married Earls. They married brothers, and they moved to northern Utah, and some of their descendants are in Logan. So I got out my digital telephone book and found some telephone numbers, started calling, and I found a man I'd met before, an Earl, who knew this man, had met him twice. He said, I didn't know him very well because he didn't come to family meetings, and I think he died in Oregon. I said, okay, well, I can't find any death dates. And I was sharing this story with the family history consultant in Santa Fe in the library, and she said, well, Elder Leonard, why don't you go on the church website, the Family Search, and look at the Social Security Index? I did. Date of death, place of death, and Social Security number. So I knew he was dead, so we reported him to the membership clerk that they could take him off the records.
That definitely is creativity in your calling.
One more story, and this is family history consultant. And Brother Scott Lewis is a convert. He lives in our ward. He's a musician, a very fine musician. One of his relatives furnished him with a family group sheet and a pedigree chart. So here he had his ancestors going back a long ways. But this was just a hobby. No one had really checked it out or done temple work. We work on a program where you go back several generations where you can use the census records from 1850 to 1930. So we picked that generation and went out and looked at the siblings of his ancestor. And we noticed a funny thing with the ancestors because it looked like they might have connected them wrongly. And as we were trying to check that out, we went into a source and clicked on that name, you know, entered that name. And up came a pedigree chart from that person back where all the temple work had been done. So a distant cousin living here in Utah, working in the temples in Utah, had joined the church and had worked back through his or her line, connected into the generation where we were looking at. And all that work's done, and now he has names of people who are working on his lines. Isn't that wonderful?
That is fun.
That's serendipity. We go looking for one thing and find something else. And, of course, the Spirit's with you when you're doing the Lord's work.
And that really is true. Mm-hmm. Really is true. Well, thank you very much, Glenn. We greatly appreciate your creativity. What a great topic you shared with us today. Thank you not only for your time today in this great interview, but also for your service to your fellow men and for the books you've written and the things you've done for your family and extended family as well. Thank you, Glenn.
It's been nice to be with you, Joe.
You've been listening to an interview between Joyce Erickson and Glenn Leonard.